Thanks again for joining us for the latest edition of the KGOU Readers Club, focusing on Going Back to T-Town, the Ernie Fields Territory Big Band. I'm KGOU Managing Editor Logan Layden, and I'm honored to be joined today by the author, Carmen Fields, the daughter of Ernie Fields, with whom I'll spend the rest of the next hour talking about her father, their family, the influence they had on the evolution of popular music in the first half of the 20th century. Carmen, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you and where are you?
I am calling you from a community just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. It's Needham, Massachusetts, and I am just great because it's not nearly as hot up here as it is out your way. Those triple digits have not reached us yet.
Yet. They may be coming. No, we've been dealing with it for quite some time, but it's hard not to be in a good mood when you hear that music. And what we're hearing today over the course of the next hour are samplings from Ernie Fields and his orchestra, who was your father. But before we get into the details of the book and your dad, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Any Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist up there in Boston? Tell us a little about Carmen Fields before we get into Ernie.
Well, I was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, graduate of Ralph J. Bunch Elementary School, Marian Anderson Junior High School, and Booker T. Washington High School of Tulsa. I went to college at Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, where at an early age, I had decided to pursue journalism. And at the time, that was the only historically Black college that had a degree program in journalism. After that, came to Boston to grad school. And after graduating from Boston University, was fortunate, gifted enough to have an opportunity at the Boston Globe newspaper and worked there for a number of years and then transferred to the broadcast field and have worked at several television stations here in the Boston area and then segued again into public affairs, community relations, media relations, both for nonprofit sectors and for corporate communications.
Well, thank you very much. And for those who aren't familiar, I just want to kind of set things up a little bit before we get into the details about Ernie Fields and the influence that he had. If you could just take some time here to basically introduce the listeners to your father, Ernie Fields, why he was important, what he did. Give us just a little sort of a general overview here before we get into the details.
Well, he was a big band leader, is how he described himself. And he, on the outside, the lettering on the outside of the buses that he traveled in, he would say Ernie Fields and his nationally famous orchestra or his world famous orchestra. He was trained as an electrician, but his fondness for music took over. And I think one of the things that drew me to his story or telling his story, sharing his story, was the fact that he was active as a musician from the late 20s into the 1960s. And that's a long span of time. Lots of so-called territory bands, lots of so-called orchestras have fallen by the wayside during that time. Very few survived that era and are continuing to perform today. The Count Basie Orchestra performs in some iteration of the bygone era, but my father's organization was one of the longest surviving that also negotiated the different musical tastes from jazz to swing to rhythm and blues to rock and roll.
I find it so interesting. We were talking before the program started here about slavery and about, you know, American history a little bit, and how for somebody like me who was born in the 1980s, who tries to do their best to understand the blight of slavery, the horrible part of history that that was for our country. And of course, the discrimination and racism that came after that and continues even to this day. I'm talking to someone, Carmen, whose dad was Ernie Fields, but whose actual direct grandfather was a slave. Tell me a little about your family's history. It's 2023, and your grandfather was a slave. It's not that long ago.
That's right, and I can remember telling a story about my grandfather. At some point, I was giving a presentation or a speech at some kind of program, and when the newspaper gave an account of my remarks, they said, made reference to my great-grandfather. They just assumed that that could not possibly have been my grandfather. But it was Thomas Jefferson Fields. And the family was particularly proud that in spite of having been a slave, by sheer will and wit, and we're not sure how that story goes, he made his way to a small Bible college in Tennessee and earned what they called his sheepskin, because at that time degrees were put on to sheepskin, and went out and became a minister, a Baptist minister. So the legacy of education has been imprinted on every member of the family since that time. He married, his wife was Mary Jane Garrett, who, as I remember as a little girl, she didn't know her specific birthday, but she would say she was born the second year of freedom. And I suspect that she or someone else gave her the birth date of December 25th, because of her deep religious convictions. But that's all we knew, that she was born the second year of freedom, and that she chose December 25th as her birthday. The family came from Texas, East Texas, to Taft, Oklahoma, one of the still surviving all-Black townships. And my grandfather was an itinerant minister and went from community to community preaching the gospel. And they had, as far as I could tell, an agrarian lifestyle. They had property and farmed that property. And after my grandfather died, my grandmother and her mother were left with this family to feed, and was bewildered. I'm not sure whether a mortgage was due or what kind of payment was due, but how were they going to survive? And her mother, my grandmother's mother, Amelia Garrett, said, "Well, when I was a slave, master would hitch us to the plow." And so these two women took turns pushing and pulling the plow, and the crops were made and the bills paid, and the rest, shall we say, is history.
Well, Ernie, your father went in a bit of a different direction. What brought him to music? As we read in the book, he was training in a trade. That's what you did. Eventually becomes this super influential band leader over the course of decades. How did that evolve?
Music was always a very important part of the family. He was the youngest of six. And as far as I can determine, at least four of the other siblings were agile in different instruments, vocal music and piano. And they would teach him, took him under their wing. And as my father took great pains to say, because he was the youngest, he wasn't spoiled, but he was what he called looked out after. So the various siblings made sure he had some musical training, and he was interested in going from place to place for these rural picnics and revivals and where there would be music and sometimes members of his family performing. And I think that lit the bug. But by the time he made it to Tuskegee, which he went to because his older brother Clarence Fields had gone ahead and had graduated from there. He got there and saw that the musicians were getting the attention of the co-eds. And so instead of baseball or football or other thing, he decided he wanted to go out for the band, but he didn't have an instrument. And the band director said he couldn't believe that Clarence had let him come to Tuskegee without a proper instrument. So he saved his money, found someone that was selling a secondhand trombone. Maybe that was the only instrument available, but he paid $3 down and owed $3 more, bought that trombone, and with another electric student who was also in the band would drill him early in the morning before they went to work at the electric plant and in the evening. And so he finally made the second, the junior band. And then some months later, after hard work, he was promoted to the big band, which traveled with the football team. And so he got a chance to see and hear other musical organizations at the colleges of the day. And that lit a spark. But he came back to Tulsa, ready to work as an electrician, had a job down on Greenwood, famed mm-hmm. Greenwood, Spots and Tate Electric Company, and was on a trouble call when he heard some music coming from one of the buildings. And he stopped by to listen, struck up a conversation, and the guys invited him to hear them at a performance, a dance or something, and to sit in or when they rehearsed. And he did, and they started kind of going around as an organization. And at some point, he's not sure whether it was because he was a little older than the guys, because most of them were still in high school, or if it's because he had some college training, he seemed a little more experienced. So they asked him to be their leader. And since he was the leader, he decided to name the organization after himself. And that's a thread throughout the book. He was very intentional about keeping his name front and center. He didn't mind the other bigger stars being featured, but he was not going to be subsumed or be just the background to another act. It could be the headliner, whether it was Bill Bojangles Robinson or Helen Humes, and the Ernie Fields Orchestra. He was insistent on that all the time.
Yeah, you make that clear in the book, and that rubbed off even on his son, Ernie Jr., as he sort of took over the band as we get into the 60s, certainly later into the book. I do wonder, before we go to our first break here, I mean, that was all, your father, Ernie, was born in 1904, is that mm-hmm. right?
So yes, and he finished Tuskegee in 1924.
Okay.
And so went to work after that. And it was in the late 20s that he began traveling around with the organization, the fledgling organization. And I was able to find a clipping, I believe, as early as 1929, talking about his orchestra, and then some in the early 30s.
Nice. A quick break for us. We'll be back here in a moment as we listen to a little bit from Ernie Fields and his orchestra. It's the KGOU Readers Club. The book is Going Back to T-Town. I've got the author, Carmen Fields, for more discussion coming up after this short break on KGOU. It's the KGOU Readers Club, and our book today is Going Back to T-Town from author Carmen Fields. I'm KGOU Managing Editor Logan Layden. We're talking about Ernie Fields today. That would be Carmen's father, influential artist in the early 20th century, the early era of jazz up through the 1960s or so. As we went to break, you talked about your father's organization, and I did want to discuss that for, you know, as you think about music today, we talk about artists, bands, groups. So often in the book, the Ernie Fields Orchestra is referred to as an organization. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit? It's a little different than what we're used to. The people that were in the band would change over time. It was almost, yeah, it was an organization. It wasn't a band.
Well, it was both of those. Yeah. It was all of that. But I guess I use organization interchangeably because it was like a unit or a club, if you will, that had members that had to be admitted and sometimes left the organization. But I think also I was trying to stress my father's entrepreneurship and that it was not just about playing the music, although that was very important and pleasing an audience was very important, but keeping the band working as an organization. That was a part of his, by sheer will, because he was not a business major or a trained businessman, but for a lot of his career, he did the promotions, he made the engagements, negotiated the contracts, et cetera. So it was an organization and, in many instances, a well-oiled machine.
Well, that seems to be the case. Yeah, it was a business that basically he ran, all the artistry and everything related to it. But at the end of the day, it was this, you know, he had to make sure he got the right people that weren't going to go off the rails. They didn't gamble too hard necessarily, didn't drink too much, although they're, you know, you kind of had to keep that in balance a little bit.
He prided himself in having a good, clean-cut, respectable people in the orchestra. And there were many instances that when he was interested in a musician, before they were hired, he would go and meet with their mothers or their family members or whoever was responsible for them to introduce himself and tell what kind of organization he was running. And that extended well into the 60s when a musician that just passed away recently in Tulsa, Leon Rollerson, was in Langston University and a bass guitar player. And he recalled to me Daddy going and sitting down with his parents to talk about his desire to have him come on the road. But that extended as far back as the 30s, that he believed in a clean cut. And yeah, there was a little drinking on the bus. Yeah, they played cards, but they weren't guys of ill repute, shall we say. They, for the most part, were clean cut and upstanding. And he insisted on that grooming and statue on the bandstand as well.
And speaking of organizations, he was, well, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's fair to describe your father, Ernie Fields, as a union man. And that's a tradition that has continued. Even you yourself are obviously we have some news happening as of late related to unions and actors and musicians.
Yeah.
But he was an early adapter there. It was pretty important to him, it seemed.
Well, that came in as part of his entrepreneurship, because from time to time when he would approach a ballroom owner or a promoter about a particular venue, they would often ask, well, are you union? And at the time he was not. And then the answer was, well, I can only hire union people here. And my father felt in some instances that that was an excuse that they used so they wouldn't have to say, we don't want any Black musicians here. We only hire union, knowing that not all of the Black organizations were union. So that was coming up in his face a lot. So the closest Black union, and the unions were segregated just then. And the only, there was a white local in Tulsa that was closed, and there was a white local in Bartlesville that was closed. The closest Black local was in Dallas. And so he became, he and all the members of the orchestra became a member of the Dallas local. But after a while, one of the rules was if you worked out of jurisdiction, you had to pay some kind of tax or penalty. So in order for him to work in Tulsa, he'd have to pay extra because he was out of jurisdiction, out of the Dallas jurisdiction. So someone suggested to him, well, you know, as many people as you have in your group, why don't you charter your own chapter? And that's exactly what he did. He investigated the number that were needed for a charter, and with all of the members of his organization, as well as some of the local Black music teachers and other musicians in the area, they established local number 808 in the late 30s. And one of the benefits was that the union set a minimum wage standard for what you got paid at the different engagements. And it also had a death benefit. Never mind that the benefits for a dead Black musician was $500 insurance policy. And for whites, it was $1,000. It was still a benefit that they hadn't had before when they were not a member of the union.
Hmm. Well, it's fascinating. Let's get into the music itself and your dad's influence on that, Ernie Fields and his orchestra. He was always adapting. It looks like, I mean, he was active from, like you say, the 20s all the way up into the 60s. Just tell us a little bit about the evolution of that. There's a story that you tell in the book, and I'm not going to make any presumptions about your age, but the bus that they would travel around in and, they come by and pick him up, and you're out in the front yard and crying that he was leaving. This was back on that early bus. Ernie Fields is not some obscure guy. If you look into it, he was very influential, but certainly the beginnings of his organization were pretty humble. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the very first bus was a used bus that he had gotten, I believe. One of the dealerships alerted him that another big band was trading in and getting a brand new bus. So he got that bus. And Renee Hall, one of the longtime members of his group and his principal arranger, too, said they called the bus the stagecoach because if you were sitting in the back, you couldn't see out the windshield because it was slanted in a certain way. Later, a few years later, he was able to get a brand new bus and was proud because he paid cash for it. And it had two tanks, two 40-gallon tanks, one on each side. And one of the stories that I tell in the book, he was not one waving flags or protesting or what have you, but being on the road, you never knew when you were able to get services or not, whether that be food or restrooms or whatever. So he would pull into a service station. He would keep one tank full all the time. And when the other one was low, he would pull into a service station and he would rationalize that, you know, nearly 40 gallons would be a pretty good haul for the average service station out in the middle of nowhere. But he would ask, if I get gas, can we use your restroom facilities? And if the attendant said no, he'd say drive on and go to where he could be served, at least with some modicum of dignity, and not have to leave his dollars where he was not being respected or appreciated.
And what were they doing at this time? This is, you know, eventually, and we'll talk a little bit if we have enough time about sort of Ernie Fields getting opportunities at Big Breaks, going more national. But what is a territory band? It's Ernie Fields and the Territory Big Band. What were they doing?
A territory band is an allusion to performing in a specific area. And so my father was based in Tulsa, and his territory was Tulsa, Dallas, St. Louis, Kansas, over into Arkansas. You just can draw a little circle around that area. And during that time, there were other territory bands, you know, out of Dallas that were going farther west or up into the Oklahoma territory, out of the in the Northeast, out of the South, there were territory big bands. And as he traveled more and more, he met more and more musicians. I mean, believe it or not, Count Basie was a territory band that they met and became friends when he would barnstorm through Oklahoma City. But that's where the territory, and they often compared notes on what was happening, wherever it was happening, get tips on performance venues, also get tips on musicians. If you're looking for a trumpet player, if you're looking for this kind of musician. And the territory bands, and that was one of the points I tried to make in the book, was they were important training grounds because they traveled into some of the biggest and plushest music theaters and dance halls to smaller Dewdrop Inns in the so-called Chitlin Circuit. There were a lot of one-nighters. My father preferred the times when he would have one or two weeks in one location. He said in one of the letters to my mother, they don't make quite as much money when it's a week-long or two-week-long stand, but they don't have to travel as much, and that makes up for it and means a lot to him to be able to stay in one place for a longer period of time. But that was the way of life, and they would play one engagement, and it's not uncommon for the next engagement to be maybe 400 miles away, and you get on the bus as soon as that gig ends and drive those 400 miles and hope you get there in time to set up the bandstand and go on and perform and give a show. He was very proud about playing what the audience liked or expected, keeping a certain caliber as opposed to what he personally preferred. And that's why he leaned on arrangers, Leslie Sheffield, who was out of Oklahoma City, Parker Berry, who was out of Ohio, and Renee Hall, out of Louisiana, who went on, who was in this band in the 30s when they did the recordings at in 1939, after he was discovered by John Hammond, the great talent scout and jazz impresario. Rene Hall was with him then, later left the organization and established himself as a studio musician and arranger in Hollywood, California, and would play a role in the subsequent rock and roll recordings. He was the arranger on many of those and had parlayed his relationships to get for my father getting a contract. And then after that, when my brother, Ernie Fields Jr., had soured on leading a band as our father had done and decided he wanted to be in one place, he came to Los Angeles and did an apprenticeship under Rene Hall again, who put him in his operation, arranging, copying, and also taught him the ropes of being a studio musician. And now he has his own business pattern, much like he learned under the tutelage of Rene Hall. He's a music contractor who arranges or hires the musicians that support many of the television shows, recording studios. He just finished a stint as a contractor for American Idol. Mm-hmm. And he's been that primary contractor, I guess, about 10 years or so, as well as other such performance television specials.
Well, Ernie's influence, you know, spans generations. And you talked about these, you know, these territory big bands, obviously, and he was an excellent businessman in addition to being a great musical talent and had a nose for great musical talent. It didn't stay in the Midwest. You know, he had an opportunity, or I mean, we're talking about the West Coast, the East Coast.
Yes.
And
yes.
I wouldn't say that he necessarily ever got his big break, but he was super close at one point, right? Wasn't he supposed to go national on NBC? Ella Fitzgerald sort of got in the way of that.
They would tease each other about that years later. But when he got to New York City, one of the big opportunities that he was hoping for was for a radio broadcast. And during that time, there were live broadcasts over the airwaves from the different ballrooms in New York City. And his promoter or manager at the time, the William Morris Agency, had promised that an opportunity like that would come his way. And he thought that was it when Chick Webb, the popular drummer, jazz drummer, he was currently at the Savoy Ballroom with that broadcast, and he passed away unexpectedly. And so my father was sure he was in line for that, but they decided Ella Fitzgerald was singing with that orchestra and she was going to be the leader. So in order to get her name more introduced and established as the leader, she became heir to that broadcast. And the next shot never came my father's way, not for that one.
He ended up doing okay, as
we
talk
about.
He did okay,
he was not one to complain either. He did not begrudge anyone anything. He considered himself richly blessed.
Indeed. Well, we've got more to discuss after a quick break from us. It is the KGOU Readers Club. We're talking about Ernie Fields and his orchestra, the book Going Back to T-Town, the author Carmen Fields. More coming up in just a couple of moments from us here on KGOU. KGOU Readers Club. Our book today is Going Back to T-Town, Ernie Fields, Territory Big Band, from author Carmen Fields, his daughter, and I am KGOU Managing Editor Logan Layden. As we continue our conversation here. So Ernie Fields is becoming nationally known by the time we get into the 40s or so, but struggles along the way. And I do want to discuss that a little bit. They were going to some places that they weren't necessarily welcome, him being a black man and having a black orchestra. And you tell some of those stories in the book, but it seemed overall he was able to handle those situations fairly well.
He did, and he considered himself blessed that violence that attended sometimes others, including people as big as Nat King Cole or Ray Charles, did not visit him, or he had some close calls. Yeah. But the most stressful time he talked about was when he dared to have a white musician travel with him in the orchestra, because that was a no-no at the time. Blacks and whites couldn't play ball on the same baseball field and couldn't ride in the same taxi. And one of the stories in the book is of a Harold Eiler out of Minneapolis, I believe, who was traveling, doing a Southern tour with him. And just everywhere it turned, the black cab driver couldn't take him to the white hotel, and et cetera. And the night of the performance, Daddy sees the owner of the ballroom in the back of the room with obviously a sheriff. And during the break, the sheriff comes over and with the manager and said, "Oh, you've been here before, haven't you?" And we're enjoying the music. And the manager says, "I was just telling the sheriff here that I'd be dogged if that doesn't look like a Creole up there instead of a white man." And Dad said, he nodded and smiled. Yes, indeed, that's what they say. And that's how they escaped that. That was in Florida, which was particularly a stickler for strict segregation. But that was, he liked to think that he would hire someone because of their musicianship, not because of the color of the skin.
Sure. And there were examples of white people being in his band. And gosh, you know, the story of pushing the bus across the city line because that town.
There weren't any blacks, yeah. Supposed to be any blacks in that town after a certain time. Yeah.
Well, fast forwarding just a little bit, some of the people, when we were talking about Ernie Fields and the influence that he had, some of the people that he came across, that he encountered, they had chances to work with, it's just a who's who of that era of jazz, and then up into the 60s. We're talking about Count Basie, of course, as we've discussed, but others as well, including Miles Davis, the one, yes, that got away.
If
you could tell us about that a little bit. Yeah.
And they, you know, they teased him about that forever. You know, Ernie Fields wouldn't fool with Miles Davis. They were in, I think it was East St. Louis or that area. And their trumpet player had to go back to Boston to bury a relative. I think it was his father. And apparently Miles had been around them while they were playing and kept seeming like he might be interested in the group. And so they were going to be there for about a week. So they asked Miles if he'd want to go with them over to Mounds, Illinois. And he said yes, and he did. Well, after the week was over, Daddy said, "Well, he seems like he plays pretty fair, but you really can't find him back there. You can't hear him." And Miles Davis, as you may know, years later, was famous for his soft, subdued tones. And so they decided against taking him further on the tour. And after that, it became the butt of many a joke that Ernie Fields wouldn't fool with Miles Davis. But there were others. I'm quick to mention Leroy Cooper was with his organization for a long stint, and later went on to be a mainstay as baritone sax with the Ray Charles Orchestra. Harold Minerve was a Duke Ellington mainstay. He had started my brother out on his clarinet lessons. The list goes on. Freddie Green, a mainstay for about 50 years with Count Basie. Harold Singer, who settled in Europe and became a star in his own right. Hal Cornbread Singer, as he was known. But the list goes on. And like I say, it was a training ground. Some went on to fame and fortune. Some started their own organizations or trios that stayed in one spot. Others became preachers, teachers, drivers, the whole gamut of professions. But my father stressed that they must have been worth something, or I never would have had them in my group.
Yeah, one of the ones that kind of strikes me a little bit is Jim Halsey. We did just recently here on KGOU, we have a podcast called How Curious that sort of dove into Jim Halsey's history and bringing country music to the Soviet Union. But he also had some pretty nice things to say about Ernie Fields, and they encountered each other as well. And he's still around.
I know. Yeah. I interviewed him for the book as well. Yes. And he was one of the first people to book my father, because when he was still in college, when he started booking musical acts around the Kansas and Missouri area. Yeah. And they remained friends for life.
Yes, indeed. And one of the things that you've done sort of, it seems like at least at your father's request, as you put this book together, and I want to talk about that here real quick as we get toward the end, the effort that went into this. You didn't start writing this in 2018, or this goes back to conversations you had with your father back in the
80s. In the 80s. He was alive when we started talking about the possibility of a book, and very wholeheartedly embraced the notion. And when I would come home to visit, we would take some time to do interviews that I recorded. And I also taught him how to use a tape recorder so that if he thought of something when I was not there, he could make the recordings himself. And that became the foundation. But as time goes on, I doubted myself. I doubted the project. Oh, maybe I'll do a fictionalized something. Oh, maybe I'll this. Then I changed jobs, and then I got married. Then there were all these starts and stops. But fast forward to the pandemic, no longer did I have the excuse, I don't have time to write. So I picked up all of those various pieces and transcriptions of the conversations and put the pedal to the metal, as they say, and really seriously over about a 2-year period came up with the manuscript.
If you could put your father's career in sort of perspective a little bit as far as his influence on that whole era of music, it was evolving all the time from when he started in the 20s up until the 60s. He didn't have his first... This is interesting as well. He did get a chart topping, or at least close to chart topping hit, and was described as kind of this young new thing when he was in his 50s. We're talking about we're up into
newcomer.
The 60s.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
At this
yes,
point.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And that the arc of the story, I tried to start it with his discovery by John Hammond, and his early recordings, his triumph at the Apollo Theater in the 30s, and then end it with his biggest musical triumph, which was In the Mood recording. And that led to appearances on national television, traveling all over the country with renewed interest. And that was a very enjoyable time for him. But I guess if I would summarize, I'd mentioned the importance as a training ground and teaching other musicians what it takes to be a performer also his entrepreneurship and his work ethic, I wanted to emphasize, and his sense of integrity, because from time to time he would run into not so savory promoters that wanted to use various gimmicks that he didn't appreciate, and he wouldn't go along with it. So I'm not trying to nominate him for sainthood. I mean, he was just a man, but it was important for me to at least document his contribution to the music scene in a very important era in our nation's musical anthology.
Now, he seems a good man. Not that he was necessarily opposed to gimmicks himself. We can talk about the one-legged dancers and the upside down.
Mr. Upside Down.
Yes, Mr. Upside Down. So, you know, he was a businessman. He was also looking for attractions, but
he believed in putting on a show for sure.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And wanted to whatever the audience liked. For example, because Oklahoma had an interest in country and Western, he liked to have someone who could double on the violin so that depending on the audience, he could throw in either jazz violin or some country and Western. And he was a great beneficiary of his friendship with Bob Wills, who at the time was one of the biggest country Western stars in the country, if not in that whole region, who opened many doors of performance venues that typically would have Bob Wills and those of that ilk. But he would drop my dad's name and the proprietors would call and say, well, Bob Wills told us to call you and he guaranteed we'd be satisfied. So that opened many, many a door for him, including the one at historic Kane's Ballroom, which will be celebrating its centennial in 2024. Ernie Fields was the first African-American orchestra to perform there. And Bob Wills threatened not to come back himself if they didn't allow Ernie Fields to perform there.
Carmen Fields, daughter of Ernie Fields, this has been a real pleasure. Thanks for joining me today. We got to about 10% of the things that I wanted to talk about, but that's how it goes.
That's how it goes. But thank you so much for your interest and your time.
Of course. You have a good rest of your day. That is the KGOU Readers Club. That was Carmen Fields, author of Going Back to T-Town, the Ernie Fields Territory Big Band. I'm KGOU Managing Editor Logan Layden. If you missed any of the conversation today, tune in next Sunday at noon for an encore presentation. This has been the KGOU Readers Club as Ernie Fields takes us out.